Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show. That's a good one.
Yeah.
For him. He rolls a lot of R's.
Yeah, he does.
He's not a fast talker.
No, he takes his time.
He does.
Yeah.
Unless he's angry, then he speeds it up.
That's right.
We are the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast that talks about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list, and we have thrown that out the window lately.
Mm-hmm.
And we are talking today. We are doing, as you said a minute ago, the final Feratu.
Yes.
As of now.
Yes.
Nosferatu 2024,
mm-hmm.
which we'd previously done the original.
1922.
And the Werner Herzog remake from 1979. They were both, you know, a laugh riot. And here we are covering the newest remake. The remake that I never thought this was going to happen. Because this is one of those movies where, like, I think I heard about it multiple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was like, oh, Robert Eggers wants to. I think it was, what was his last movie? Lighthouse?
Yeah.
After The Lighthouse, it was like, oh, his next thing he wants to do. No, I'm sorry. It's The Northman. That was the most.
Oh, right.
After The Northman. Actually, you know what? I think it might predate The Northman. I think it was after The Lighthouse that it was like, oh, Robert Eggers wants to do Nosferatu. And I was like, yeah okay. I'll believe that when
I see it.
Sure. And then here we are.
Talking about the final Feratu.
He did it.
He done did it.
A round of applause, everyone. this is not on our list, but it does.
You're Clay, by the way.
I'm Clay. With me, as always, is Amanda. Listen, if they're this deep, they know who we are.
That's fair.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, but I will be addressed as the honor of my blood commands it.
He's old enough where he probably wasn't actually a count. He probably just decided to call himself that after a while, right?
Lord. Maybe it's just like the closest English translation to whatever the title was.
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah. Languages.
How do
idiomas,
they work?
As the Spanish would say. this has 84% Rotten Tomato score and a 73% score, audience score, which I'm looking forward to talking about audience response to this.
Yes, me too.
Because you and I, well, just to move right into the next section, we saw this together.
We did.
I don't think it was open. Was it opening weekend? It was very early.
It was very early. It was sort of that week, I think, in between Christmas and New Year's.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty packed house.
Yes, it
including
was.
One girl who was in costume.
Yes, full Orlok drag. It was amazing.
Classic Orlok.
Yes.
Which was very fun. I'm actually curious what she thought of the movie.
Hilariously, she seemed deeply confused that more people weren't dressed up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which was so funny to me. We can get into it.
Okay, we'll get into that later. But yeah, this is, if you've listened to the other episodes, you probably have surmised that Nosferatu, the story is a big, one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Dracula as a whole, I've said many times, might be my favorite story, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always here for a Dracula movie or a tangential Dracula movie. I love secret Dracula movies.
Yes.
But I understand why they don't make more of them.
It's the kind of thing, you got to be careful with it, right?
Yeah.
Like it can get really hokey if you're not choosy with how you introduce your secret Dracula.
Yeah, like there was a movie that came out, I've probably mentioned this before, a couple years ago, called The Invitation. Not the good movie, The Invitation, that we watched previously.
Oh, it was this sort of like kind of gothic romance-ish horror movie.
Yeah, turns out, well, it looks stupid.
Yeah.
It didn't look very good.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm never going to watch this. And then I found out it was a secret Dracula movie.
I feel like they tried to market it like it was not a YA Bridgerton Dracula.
It was kind of Bridgerton Dracula.
Is sort of how it read in the marketing, and I feel like it maybe.
However, here's my beef.
Mm.
First of all,
yes,
I was right. It was not good. Second of all, it was a secret Dracula movie, which on its face, great idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always here for that.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't embrace it because they never said the word. So they danced around it for the entire movie, and it's like you figured out, okay, they're talking about Dracula, but they never said the word Dracula, and it's very cowardly as far as I'm concerned.
A cowardly Dracula movie is worse than a bad Dracula movie.
I think so.
Yeah.
Spoilers for the movie The Ballerina. Remember that? Was it The Ballerina? The one with the little girl. Dan Stevens was in it. And it's like a bunch of people are hired to... Anyway, she's a monster. She's a vampire. And also, Secret Dracula movie.
Oh.
Yeah, I also don't think that they say Dracula in that one, but that was a better movie than anyway. Anyway.
All right.
On to a good Dracula movie.
Finally.
That was a long way of me saying I was very excited to hear that Robert Eggers was making this.
Yes.
Because he has the sensibilities for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty sure it was not going to be campy.
Yes.
And I think I was right.
Yeah, I was excited when I heard it was him doing it because tonally his other films, just especially like The Lighthouse, where it toes that line between... It's sort of a horror movie period piece, but it's also just like very weird.
Yeah.
Like some deeply off-putting and disturbing imagery and stuff. Like, he's not afraid to get really weird with it, which I actually thought was good.
Yeah. The one thing I was surprised by is I think that this might be his most commercially accessible movie that he's made so far.
Yeah, which is hilarious to say.
It is.
Yeah.
You haven't seen Northman, right?
No, not yet.
Northman is awesome.
I really want to.
Even that is like just weird enough that I think it could be kind of off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is like, I was surprised at how straight he plays it, pretty much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, because this is a remake, you know, the story...
A
tale as old as time.
As one teapot might say.
But the Nosferatu story alone, without, you know, getting into the Dracula underpinnings of it all, has been around for over 100 years.
Yep.
So it's a little more accessible because there's more kind of general awareness of it, I think.
Yeah.
As opposed to his other movies where a lot of them, I think all of them are original, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They're inspired by true events and other things.
Technically, Northman's one of those ones where it's like, it's based on some Icelandic saga that is the same thing that Hamlet's based on.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which, you know, there's...
He really likes Hamlet, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some similarities once you see it. Oh, the main guy's name is like Amleth or something.
Okay.
Anyway, we're talking about Nosferatu. We're going to play the trailer for you. We'll be right back to talk.
Come to me. Come to me. Hear my call. Come to me. Professor. My dreams grow darker. Evil come from within us, or from beyond. He is coming.
He is coming.
He is coming to us.
He's coming.
Who is coming to you, my child?
We are here encountering the vampire. Nosferatu.
Okay, Nosferatu. Directed by Robert Eggers. Written by Robert Eggers, based on the screenplay by Henrik Galeen, which is in turn based on the novel by Bram Stoker. Starring Lily Rose Depp, Nicholas Hoult, Aaron Taylor Johnson, Emma Corrin. You know, I couldn't believe that Emma Corrin Anna is the same person who was the villain in Wolverine and Deadpool.
Yeah.
Completely yeah. blew my mind.
She's a chameleon. She's great.
Yeah, yeah. Ralph Ineson, talk about chameleons until he opens his mouth. Simon McBurney, Willem Dafoe, and modern monster master Bill Skarsgård.
The best Skarsgård, in my opinion.
He's really... I have to give him a lot of credit for the career he's building because he has somehow managed to corner the market on playing heavy prosthetic makeup monsters, but also still be hot.
Yep.
It's a
rare talent.
It is. It's a very difficult line to walk, and he's pulling it off.
Yep.
So, Amanda.
Yes, Clay.
What happens in Nosferatu, if we don't already
if
know?
This is your first Feratu. I will tell you.
That's what the next one. It's going to be a prequel. First Feratu.
First Feratu. In the
you know what the next sequel is going to be though.
Dos Feratu.
Got it.
In the 1830s, estate agent Thomas Hutter travels to Transylvania for a fateful meeting with Count Orlok, a prospective client. In his absence, Hutter's new bride, Ellen, is left under the care of their friends, Friedrich and Anna Harding. Plagued by horrific visions and an increasing sense of dread, Ellen soon encounters an evil force that's far beyond her control.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Clay, some things you'll find in the 2024 version of Nosferatu include... The coolest, most normal boss!
Mm-hmm. Just a chill dude.
Just really normal.
Excited that you got married, wants to give you a raise.
Yeah, wants to talk about how hot your wife is.
That's what everybody talks about in this movie.
And, you know, use his own blood to draw some esoteric symbols and sit in a giant pentagram surrounded by candles on his floor in the dark.
As one does.
Yeah. Normal Tuesday night.
Yep.
Yeah. Cheekbones.
Yes, many.
Many. Everybody has such cheekbones in this movie.
You could say literally everyone in the movie has cheekbones, but
you know,
prominent.
Prominent.
Chiseled.
Chiseled faces.
From stone, yes.
Puns.
So here's the thing that I think we can all learn from movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're talking to someone, even someone you know very well, and they start making what sounds like might be a pun involving like eating or flesh or blood or something like that, run away. Because there's no instance in which someone says, well, he wants to see you in the flesh, so to speak. And you go, oh, that sounds normal. I think that's probably fine.
Another totally off-topic plug for the TV show Hannibal, but it is full of Mads Mikkelsen
making
hilariously obvious cannibal puns.
That should have
and
been...
And everybody just going, what a guy.
Yeah, that makes me think Will Graham is a terrible detective. Yeah. Like, he should have been like, this is...
And everyone else around him, too.
Yeah, nobody else... He's just laughing. He thinks this
is hilarious.
He keeps
saying, I would love to have you for dinner, and... Oh, yeah, all those things. Evil naked needlepoint.
Yeah, it's not needlepoint, but it looks like it.
Yeah, it's more fun to call it that.
Yeah, as one does.
Okay. Yeah. A plus coat game.
Unbelievable coat game.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe's jacket. So
that is like your platonic ideal of that jacket.
I forget what those are called. I think it's the one that I had on at our Victorian Christmas party. Is I believe an Inverness coat.
Ooh.
But I think the ones that he's wearing is something different because I think those have the shorter shoulder flap things.
Oh, okay.
But his had three. They were layered. Three layers of cool shoulder flaps.
Triple decker shoulder flaps.
They make you look so cool.
And all of Gen Z agrees.
Yes.
Can
we make that? Can we hire a child to make that a trend on TikTok? Is just,
I mean, for probably about 36 hours, we absolutely could. Yeah. A couple years ago, there was a whole thing about sea shanties.
That's right.
For like 2 weeks.
That's right.
So anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Corn was a trend for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
The vegetable, not.
Yeah, there's that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just think about that for a little while.
Hmm.
Anyway, you'll also find stronger accent choices than even Gary Oldman.
Yeah, I want to talk about this probably at length later.
Yes.
But man, he just... Bill Skarsgård looked at every actor ever to play Dracula or Dracula-related subject matter and said, hold my bag of blood.
Challenge accepted.
Hold my glass of wine, because I ain't going to drink this.
A whole village's worth of harbingers.
Yeah. Does it count as a harbinger if you can't understand what they're saying?
Yeah.
I guess they're
trying to warn you. Yeah. And you might not understand exactly the words, but I think they got the sentiment across very well.
Good, pretty solid body language.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
If you walk
spitting in a circle and crossing yourself and muttering prayers.
Much like meat and food-based puns. If you ever walk into a room and announce what your plans for the evening are, and everybody there starts crossing themselves, probably you should find something else to do.
You are about to fuck up.
Yeah.
Yes. Revenge of the Beachfront Cemetery.
You know,
last time we had Return of the Beachfront Cemetery. So now it's Revenge of the Beachfront Cemetery.
By 50s monster movie naming conventions, that's where we would go.
Exactly.
My question that only occurred to me this time. There's no bodies buried there, right? Is it just, I assumed it was crosses for people who died at sea.
It's a good assumption.
Because I feel like burying a body in loose sand.
Oh, it's a horrible idea.
It's not a great idea.
Yeah, it's not going to work. They're gonna end up exposed and eaten by crabs and all sorts of shit.
You ever go, I'm sure I know the answer to this, but you ever go to those like...
I was gonna say, ask me anyway, I bet the answer's yes.
Those older cemeteries that have like... So we went to one a couple years ago that was very hilly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a lot of these grave plots that were on hills.
Yes.
And they had those, they were kind of raised and they had like this, the stone kind of around the plot.
Yes.
And it was an old place. So those things were like broken and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The fear instilled in me by Michael Jackson's Thriller is so just built into my core that walking through there, I'm like, the stone is kind of broken. Am I going to see like a foot?
No.
They're very deep in the ground.
They're also very old.
Yeah. Yeah. But still,
everything
it's weird.
Is going to be disintegrated.
It's weird to me.
Yeah. It is. It's the coming out of the earth potential for you, right? It's less mausoleums and more graves.
No, mausoleums are pretty creepy too.
Okay.
Because those are like, they keep the door shut so you don't know what's going on in there.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Unless you go to some of them where they're really old and kind of falling apart and the doors
they
are
busted
open.
They had those there too. Yeah. I don't want to go in there. Who knows what's going on in there?
I do, but I have to be respectful. I could talk about cemeteries for the next 2 hours. So
maybe we'll do that on Patreon someday.
Yay. If people are interested, I'm happy to talk about
my
international cemetery explorations.
Next year will be 12 episodes about Amanda's
my
walking through
top 12 favorite cemeteries in the whole world. Number 12. Anyway, you'll also find a congestion of the blood / a corset to quote unquote calm the womb.
Yeah, that's
in case it gets riled up.
You got to just cinch it in there.
Strap it in there.
Because you don't just want it like.
Well, they used to believe it would like part of women's hysteria was that they had a womb that was like essentially floating around in them.
Yeah.
Like your womb was like moving and stirring things up in a bad way.
I do like that science for a long time was basically at the level of Dr. Nick from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Where he's like, what you have is your skeleton is trying to jump out of your body through your mouth.
Yes, exactly.
Did you ever see The Nick, the show The Nick?
No, we've talked about this before. I know I gotta get on that one.
But there's a bit with some 1900 or 19th century psychiatry, which is just like, buddy. Ooh.
Oh boy.
A guy.
Can only
imagine. I won't tell you because you should watch it.
I would like to watch it. One of the best exorcism scenes ever. That's not even an exorcism.
Yeah.
That when Von Franz comes to Ellen and she is like seizing and foaming at the mouth and being generally terrifying. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. It's the same thing that I do when someone says, how do you, what if we got buffalo wings? And then I'm like,
and then you start saying that everyone will be crying and there will be no one left to bury the dead.
Yeah, basically. You stick around long enough. Yeah.
Dracula's dong or Vlad's impaler.
That's very clever.
That was all you.
Ah.
I will not take false credit for your brilliance. A Paracelsian.
You know, sorry, let's go back real quick.
Sure, you want to talk more about how smart you are?
No. I want to talk about how, as someone who doesn't want to see Dracula's feet, I can't say that I want to see his dick much more. So,
well, this movie will give it to you whether you like it or not.
Yep.
Which should be the tagline that's for the theme. The film.
Yeah, that's the theme of the whole movie.
A Paracelsian.
Yeah.
He's back.
He's back.
He's a Paracelsian again.
Do you know much about alchemy? You seem like an alchemist.
Thank you. I know.
How much lead do you have in your house?
Very.
In a boiling pot.
I know how much lead I have in my garden plot.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I could like pull up the thing
have
right
you,
now and tell you.
You. Not boiling in a pot, though?
No, just dispersed in the
trying
dirt.
To think about the stars until it turns to gold?
No. Hermes, I misjudged the stars, and Hermes will not perform this miracle for me.
I've always been curious about that, how long that was, if that was really a thing, and how long it was a thing for.
If alchemy was really a thing?
Yeah.
I mean, there were people who sincerely believed in it.
Yeah.
And there were people who were essentially doing chemistry, mm-hmm. and it was just seen as this, like, unbelievable, must be mystical somehow, because you mix this and this and it turns into this other thing.
Yeah.
And people just didn't understand that at the time that it was just a chemical reaction.
Mm.
But
sure.
Yeah. Alchemists were real. Not saying they were really doing magic, but they were real.
I feel like at a certain point in history, if you just had a lot of pots boiling in your house,
oh yeah,
people would believe anything you say.
Or burn you as a witch.
That too. Yeah.
Those are, if you're a man, they believe anything you say. If you're a woman, you're probably a witch.
Yep.
Yep. Boat stuff?
Boat stuff.
Just boat stuff.
Says it all. Can't have a good Dracula movie without boat
Cannot
stuff.
Cannot. Need the boat stuff. As I like to call it, you'll also find a reverse Christmas Carol.
Mm, explain.
In A Christmas Carol, the Marley ghosts come and say, you will be visited by three spirits. You have, mm-hmm. like, these three. And in this, instead, it's, you will have three nights, and each night I will kill those you love until you surrender yourself willingly to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he flies into your bedroom and gives you a horrible prophecy about the future.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Christmas
Interestingly,
time.
Which one do you think is more effective? Because, I mean, nobody dies in the Christmas Carol.
I think they're equally effective. It's just which one would you rather go through? And personally, for me, it's A Christmas Carol.
Mm.
I would rather come out the other end with a warmer heart and alive.
Yeah, it does end with a giant turkey.
Yeah. Tiny Tim.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something to be said about negative reinforcement, is all I'm saying.
About Vlad's Impaler, you mean?
Yeah.
Magic books.
Yeah, when this movie started, at the spot in the story where Hutter is supposed to get a magic book, there was no magic book.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, points off the board
for
this
one. Yeah.
And then there was like eight of them at the end. And I was like, okay, we're
just
back.
Just a full bookshelf of magic books.
Bookshelf.
Yes.
Skull on top of a bone pentagram. Everything you could possibly want.
Everything written in human blood.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And last, but certainly not least, you will find things that would have made Sir Isaac Newton climb back into his mother's womb.
Great line. And every time, the three times that I've seen this, whenever he gets to that line, all I think of is in Ghostbusters when Winston says, I have seen shit that'll turn you white, which is basically the sentiment.
Yeah.
Okay. Nosferatu. 2024, the sensitive story of when your spouse's ex booty call comes back to town.
Mm.
This is, if we want to look at the board here, we've got American movie based on a German movie, which is based on an Irish book, which was illegally based on an Irish book, which was remade once visually similar to the original German movie with names taken from the Irish book.
Yes.
We've kind of collapsed the universes here. And now we've got, based on the original German movie.
Yes.
With the original German names.
Yes.
Which, as I've said before, is the way I like my Ferratu.
Yes.
Because, and I think this is, I want to say, so, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about Nosferatu 79,
mm-hmm.
but this movie for me was like a 2-hour guitar solo.
Yes.
And that doesn't necessarily mean it's my favorite version, which we can get into at the end.
Interesting.
But this was just like everything I wanted it to hit.
Yeah.
It just hit hard.
Yeah.
The costumes, the lighting,
mm-hmm.
the music, the set design. It's all incredible.
Yes.
The thing about this one is that the thing that impressed me the most that I was really on the fence on, and I want to hear how you feel about this. Nosferatu, generally, as I've said before, Nosferatu is kind of its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you say Nosferatu, a very clear picture appears in your head.
Yes.
They did not make a vampire that looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
They made something completely different.
Yep.
That is somehow, and this is the thing that I'm most impressed with. I already said that once, but from the design and also from a Bill Skarsgård point of view, they managed to make a Dracula that is iconic.
Yep.
And different.
Yep.
And scary.
Yes.
I was not ready for Dracula's mustache, is what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm happy it was there.
That seems to have distracted you even more than his impaler.
Well, no, I actually, when I saw the mustache, so when I first saw him,
yeah,
what he looked like, yeah. I was like, okay, interesting.
Mm.
I can't decide if I like that they've made him like more human looking, because Orlok is generally more like monstrous.
Yeah.
Not that this guy isn't monstrous, but his features are more human than rat like.
Yes and no.
And he's got hair, sort of.
Sort of.
And he's got this big bushy mustache. Yeah. And I love the mustache because that's actually something from the book that no one has ever done.
Yep.
I think maybe once.
Yep, yep.
Which is one of the things where people are like, well, I don't know, I dread you have your mustache. Like, read the book.
Yeah.
A mustache in the book. But this is just me trying to wrangle my thoughts about
the appearance of this version.
Because it's so different than what I was expecting,
yeah.
Which caught me off guard, but ultimately I think is so very cool.
Yeah.
And so very well done. And they managed to do something new inside a story that's over 100 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I immediately loved it.
Yeah.
I was on board with this version of Count Orlok pretty much right away because it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that he would look and dress more like someone from the region he is from.
Mm-hmm.
And
instead of like an English prince.
Or even the kind of classic Count Orlok look where he's so immediately legible as like unhuman and it just so stunning looking with that extremely white, pristine, kind of smooth head.
Yeah.
And the ears, it's all very prominent. And that sort of bat or rat-like face.
He does wear the hat just for fun in this one.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to hide his ears like the original.
Yes. But I loved that he sort of looks like he was once part of this culture.
Yeah.
And he dresses still the way that would have been familiar to him when he was alive. And I loved that he's so physically imposing, because I don't think we get very physically imposing Dracula or Orlok figures anymore.
Generally, not in this way anyway.
Yeah, not in this, like, he's tall and he's like inhumanly broad. He's got
that huge coat.
Yeah, but he's also just big.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like Nicholas Holt's not a small guy.
Yeah.
And in the scenes where Orlok is feeding off of Hutter, he has to like curl his whole body just to like put his head down to Hutter's chest, because he's so big. He's so much bigger than him.
I mean, all the Skarsgårds are like 6'5".
Right. So. Right. But I mean, there's something about that physical presence and the immediate, like, with that and the coat and the heavy mustache and just his general face, like, you would look at that figure in the room with you and immediately be overwhelmed by it and immediately be intimidated. He didn't need, you know, he doesn't need to like open his mouth or be particularly like warlike or physically aggressive in his movements. Like he can move very slowly and kind of ploddingly towards you. And it's still terrifying because he's just huge.
I would say one of the biggest differences about him in this movie, in this version, is that I don't think you see him move hardly at all.
Yeah, he sort of shifts a little bit or touches some, things.
And he does some like supernatural movement, but I don't even know if you see him walk at any point in this movie.
Very short distances, like a couple
and
paces.
He definitely doesn't one arm a coffin through town looking for his house.
In my notes, I did note that we miss the Dracula packing his dirt for his long vacation.
But it's like this is kind of the platonic ideal of what I want my Dracula to be like.
Right. It goes to your I don't want to see his feet
right
thing.
Yeah. He's very much a shadow. He's very much just part of the landscape of the of the room or whatever that you're in. He's a presence and a power and a feeling more than he is like a guy in a night suit or a night suit.
Yeah. Suit of armor.
Yeah.
But I also like that he feels like an ancient feudal lord.
Yeah.
Not a fancy British count or prince or whatever. Like he feels like he is rural and like he is from a warlike people. There's nothing really genteel about him. Which I think is great. And I also think it was really a really cool choice to have him kind of rotting and falling apart.
Yeah.
If he's this physical embodiment of death and decay, having him actually be decaying really adds to that grotesqueness, that unnaturalness about him, even before you fully see it. Like the first couple times you glimpse him like without the hat or like his skin a little bit closer and you realize that it's falling apart. He's falling apart. It makes perfect sense then that he is bringing plague wherever he goes.
Yeah, and that big coat and big hat is kind of a front, really.
Yeah, that's his disguise. Yes.
But I find it so interesting that the sort of subversive thing that they do with Dracula in this is actually make him imposing.
Yeah.
And like he's not generally the way that Dracula, even Orlok, is played to a certain extent. Is kind of disarming.
Yeah.
Weird, but disarming. Yeah. Like even Kinski's Orlok or Dracula is pretty weird.
Absolutely.
But he's fairly disarming. He's kind of like reserved and
he's
you know,
got this soft spoken thing going on we talked about. And both he and I am horribly blanking on the man who originally played Orlok in the 1920s.
Max Schreck.
Thank you.
Villain of Batman Returns. Played by Christopher Walken.
But they're both kind of especially the way they're costumed, it makes them seem very slim and very almost like waifish, like kind of wasting away. And they, you know, got the long, slim fingers and like these long, skinny arms in the tight black coat. You know what I mean? They're very like just kind
look
of
like
this
Matt Gaetz kind of.
Whereas this version of Orlok is so robust.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
In all ways.
Even if he is falling apart at the same time, there's just so much more to him physically.
Yeah. And he doesn't meet you at the door the way that Dracula traditionally does. You come to him.
Yes.
And he's mad that you're late.
Yes.
Also, I appreciate he doesn't go out of his way to make good food for him.
Nope.
He's like, the guys are gone. Here's some bread.
Yep. Fucking deal with it.
No rooster display in this one. But yeah, it's on top of the visuals, Bill Skarsgård knows the value of a good voice.
Yeah.
It's something that I think a lot of people, for whatever reason, like to clown on generally when an actor makes a strong vocal choice.
Yeah.
But like, he has this is the thing that keeps blowing me away about this is like he has essentially managed to make himself the most like at least the third most well-known Dracula at this point. Like yeah. You've got Lugosi,
mm-hmm.
probably Christopher Lee. And then the next thing people are probably going to go to from here on out is him because he's got a voice you can do.
Yep.
And everybody saw this movie.
Yeah.
And he's not just a guy in a tuxedo.
Yeah.
And it's just like in most other movies, a swing this big, I don't think would work.
Mm.
But in a 2-hour guitar solo of a movie, you know, when you start hitting those tasty licks and then the fireworks start shooting out of the end of your guitar,
uh-huh.
people are like, awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
Is he the fireworks?
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Just trying to follow the metaphor.
Yeah, it's all over the place. but it's just and he's someone who clearly doesn't mind being completely physically transformed because he doesn't look anything like Skarsgård.
No.
I'll be honest with you. For a long time, I didn't even know what that guy looked like. Because the only thing I had seen him from was It.
Mm.
And I think there was something else I had seen him in where he was under a bunch of makeup. And probably. I was like, I don't even know what this actor looks like. He looks more like Pennywise than I thought he did. Did you know that weird Pennywise smile is real? Like, that's not CGI. That's just something he does with his face.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, can't he do the weird thing with his eyes, too?
I think so. Yeah.
The, like, one eye going over one direction, the other one going in the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird guy. Found the perfect way to use all of these rare and unusual talents.
Yeah. I mean, even from a career standpoint, he found a way to stand out from his brother. Is there a third one? Is there a third Skarsgård?
Yeah, I think so.
Is he like the third Hemsworth where he's like not really in stuff?
I don't know.
No.
Anyway. I don't follow many Skarsgårds other than him and Stellan.
Yeah. I thought there was a fourth one. I thought Peter Sarsgaard was a Skarsgård, but he's not. He's a Sarsgaard.
Yeah. I also know that he studied like Mongolian throat singing.
Oh, really?
To help him achieve that voice.
Sure.
So it's, you know, he made a choice and really committed, which I respect.
Yeah, and I think it works. I think it's very, like I said, it's very imposing.
Yeah.
And from I love the way that he is presented. And like this is one of those movies where as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is all the choices I would have made. This is so fucking good. Like the fact that they don't even show his face.
Yes.
For like 45 minutes is great.
And I love that scene. I know we're jumping all over the place with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to do it this way because we've talked about the plot of this movie 2 times already.
Yes.
So
more if you count Dracula.
True.
Full.
Yes. You know, many umbrella. Times. Many, many times. But I loved that the first scene with Orlok when Hutter has gotten to the castle finally and they are sitting down to sort of talk about the deal and the paperwork and he's eating his little hunk of bread or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps the camera keeps pretty close on Hutter's face.
Mm.
Not always a close up, but it's always, you know, more focused on his face than most other things in the room. And I love the way they did that because you just watch his reaction as he looks at Orlok or tries not to look at Orlok and is getting increasingly upset and stressed out and freaked out by what's happening. And just watching him go from as he comes in and Orlok is backlit so he can't really see him. He looks sort of concerned and a little confused, but he's, you know, all right. And then as they get physically closer and he sits at the table with him, you just see his eyes start to get like, oh, fuck, what is happening here? And then he like won't make eye contact and he starts to sweat. Mm-hmm. His like watching it through him first before you even see his face is a really clever way of doing it.
Yeah. And they really... It's one of the other reasons I think that voice is so important is because that is the character for a good portion of at least the early parts when he's on screen.
Yeah.
Because you're not seeing him.
Yeah.
He doesn't move a lot. And so that voice has to do a lot of work.
Yeah.
And the way we saw this at the Coolidge. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it was on film. Mm-hmm. Because I remember thinking, like, there is something about the way that this movie looks that feels so dreamlike.
Yeah.
In a way that I have not seen again in the two other... I went to see it again... Did I see it in IMAX? I think I might have seen it in IMAX at AMC. And mm-hmm. then I watched it again for this.
Mm-hmm.
And each time it was progressively more clear. The image mm-hmm. was clear. And I was like... I mean, it's still awesome. But it's not yeah. as, like, the fog... That yeah. was just pervading that entire movie the first time.
Yeah.
Because of that little bit of extra diffusion you get from film
mm-hmm.
is just like, it's such a cool look. And the yeah. everything being lit by candles and
mm-hmm.
handheld lamps and stuff, yeah. or torches.
Yeah.
With just enough smoke in the air to make things a little mm-hmm. bit tough to see. It's
like,
it's,
especially the scene when he gets into the inn.
Yeah,
with the Romani people mm-hmm. and all of that, and it's so smoky in there, and they're, you know, crossing themselves and praying at the windows, and they're all kind of quiet and around different tables, and it's just the fireplace and the, like, wall sconces with candles are the only light.
Yeah,
yeah.
Speaking of that, let's get a little bit into the story, because as you said, we've covered this basic story twice before.
Yes,
there are some changes in this one. That are, I think that they are in line with the basic idea of, like, it's not really changing anything, but mm-hmm. it's kind of like leaning into certain aspects.
Sure.
The one that is right up front mm-hmm. is they really accentuate the connection, the pre-existing connection between Orlok and Ellen.
Yes.
In a way that, like... In trying to explain it more, it's like, it's kind of inexplicable still, because it's like,
yeah.
she was really lonely and he was like, what's up, baby? And like, it's kind of what I was joking yeah. about, where it's like, yeah, when she was in college, she dated this kind of awful guy for a while. She was in a weird place, but she's better now. But he's just come back to town and yeah. is convinced that there's still something there.
But I think the thing that's at the root of it is, as Orlok says, he says, I forget the exact phrasing, but he says, I'm an appetite, nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellen kind of is too.
Mm.
She's also an appetite. She's trying to be more,
mm-hmm.
but everybody reacts to her as though she is too much. You know, when she talks about her childhood and her father, she's like, I would sleepwalk and I would have these sort of visions or moments of unreality and blah, blah, blah. And my father would find me out in the woods and he thought I was sinful. And then, you know, Anna is clearly a loving friend to her, but Anna's husband, Friedrich, does not like Ellen
mm-hmm.
and thinks she is, like, wacky and high maintenance and, like, ugh, her.
It does. The way that you said that, it did make me think that the first time the two of them came over after mm-hmm. they left, Friedrich turned to Anna, went, mm-hmm. Anna, and went, well, she's a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, is, like, she is a lot. And, like, her love for Thomas is borderline inappropriate, even though they are married.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that for the time period.
Yeah.
The way she wants him is not the way a wife is supposed to want her husband at that point in time mm-hmm. in society. Marriage at that point is still sort of a business arrangement. And you can have love and even lust. And I think Friedrich and Anna are a perfect example of that. They are a high, upper echelon, high class couple. They seem very into each other, but there is a level of propriety there.
Mm-hmm.
And Anna is very demure. She is a wife and a mother. She's kind of keeping the house and keeping the children and staying in her lane.
Mm.
And Ellen is not that. She's, like, making demands upon Thomas, but not in a give me more material things. She wants him.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, don't leave me, stay with me, not even just don't go on this business trip. She doesn't even want to let him out of bed at the mm-hmm. beginning of the movie, and she clearly lusts after him. Like, she has a lot of sexual lust, and that's not appropriate, like, for any women in that time period, even if you are married, especially not in public.
Right. Yeah.
Like, when they're over at the Hardings' house and they start to kiss, Ellen is the one who escalates it.
That was a weird scene where it's like, all right,
yeah,
we're going to go to bed. See you guys tomorrow. Yeah. Okay, see ya.
Yeah.
Good, they're gone. Let's make out hard in their drawing room.
Right, while we wait for our carriage to be prepared so we can go home, where we could be alone and make out. But we can't wait. We have to do it now.
Yeah.
And Ellen is the one who kind of always is pushing it. Like, Thomas is trying to sort of be like, no, my love, it's okay. Everything's fine. And she's the one who's, like, ravenous for him.
Yeah.
And, like, her emotions are too big. Her sexual feelings are too big. She is also similar to Orlok, an appetite. And I think von Franz even says something to that effect of, there are certain people whose, like, carnal natures are more active,
right,
and demons find that attractive. And that's, in his opinion, sort of the way that she, in her desperate pleas, drew Orlok to her, is that he felt a sort of kindred spirit of, like, you want to devour and be devoured.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I guess he was just, like, scrolling Tinder or something.
1838 Germany Tinder.
Ghost Tinder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, well, that brings us to another change. This is a much more horny version of Nosferatu than the other two, which
absolutely.
It's interesting, though, because, like, what we were taking away from the previous two, in that there's this, the chasteness of pretty much everyone, kind of underlines the Ellen's connection with Orlok. It's one thing where it seems like he's really drilling down into that. Be like, all right, what does that mean? What does this look like? It's what you're saying, I think, is a more interesting way to get at that, where instead of Hutter being this weird sexless vessel for the story, there's real sort of conflict in him, where he's going on this trip because he needs, they've just been married, he wants to be able to provide for his family. It's not like in the other ones where it's like, haha, I'm gonna make more money and also not see you.
Right. I just want to prance off through the fields. Yeah.
Should we kiss before you go? No, definitely not. It would be unclean.
Right.
Like, here it's like he's wants to be a husband to his wife, and he believes in order to do that, he needs to provide for the family.
Yes.
Which is, you know, I really like that element of, it's not just, oh, I'm selling Dracula a house. There's this element of, well, first of all, Hutter, as a real estate guy, you should know you should read these contracts before you sign them.
Right.
But, like, he knows what he's doing is bad.
Yeah.
Like, he, even though he doesn't know exactly how, it's like he's got that overcoming sense of dread.
Yes.
And then Orlok tosses the money at him.
Yeah.
And that's like, fuck, that's why I'm here. I'm doing this for... And he doesn't even realize what he's doing.
Yeah.
He doesn't realize he's signing away the rights to his wife.
Yeah. Rather than just some house. Yeah.
Yeah. Which also then leads to my favorite line in the movie, which is when he goes, Orlok goes, now we are neighbors.
Yeah.
Can I borrow your weed whacker?
But yeah, I think that it really does create that genuine tension with Hutter, where he loves Ellen. He wants to be with her. He seems to have married her, even though there's kind of a bit of a shadow over her, you know, even before they meet. Like, he knows she's had these nervous troubles in her life, and she seems to have, you know, some sort of shame that she doesn't talk about, that other people are kind of aware of, but not really clear on what it is. And he's like, I don't care. I love you. I want to, this is the woman I want to marry. And so I'm going to marry her. And he clearly is embarrassed that he owes the Hardings money. And he cannot provide for Ellen in the way he believes she should be provided for, and the way society tells him you have to provide for her in this way. Mm-hmm. You need to get her a better house. You need to be able to buy her nicer things, and so on and so forth. And so there, yeah, there's this tension of he's like, everyone is telling me this is the route to go to be successful. And if I'm successful, I'm a better husband. Mm. And Ellen deserves the best husband. So I have to try to do that. Even as he knows, like, this isn't, like, she's very vocal of, like, I don't want a better house. Right. I don't want a maid servant. I don't care about that stuff. But he still is pulled into it regardless.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it makes it... It does something very important, which is makes his character actually kind of important to the story and interesting.
Right.
Instead of, as we've seen in the last two versions, he's basically the only purpose he serves is to get Orlok to Germany.
Yeah.
And then after that, he's kind of out of the story for the most part.
Yeah. And in the other versions, the original version of Nosferatu and the Herzog version, Thomas and Ellen's stories seem so separate.
Yes.
They're having such separate experiences, and it's like we're either totally focused on Hutter or we're totally focused on Ellen, and we can kind of be with one of them or the other, but not both. Mm-hmm. And this movie lets you sort of be with both of them because they interact with each other more. It's not like he comes back from, Transylvania or wherever he's supposed to be. And he's not catatonic when he gets back in this one. He's sick, but he's still aware. Mm. And he's not like in the Herzog version when Hutter, whatever. When the husband gets back, he's like, who is this woman? Mm. Like, he doesn't even recognize his wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're so divorced from one another. And in this one, they're still very much together and experiencing this horror together. And it makes her sacrifice make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah. And it makes it so much more sad.
Yeah.
And like it's in the previous versions, there's a very fairy tale kind of nature to the sacrificing of the maiden or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, you've got that, especially after she realizes that she has to do it, which is not something they really get into in the other versions.
Mm-hmm.
I love that whole section where she figures out what has to happen.
Yeah.
And she tells Willem Dafoe about it.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I'll take him on some wild vampire hunt so you can do what you got to do.
Yeah.
But like, there's this scene, this amazing scene with her and Hutter where at a certain point, she's trying to tell him what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not working. He's like, oh, I would follow you. I'm always with you, blah, blah, blah. And then she just decides to turn on a dime and starts basically insulting him and saying she doesn't want him anymore. And then he's a piece of shit and stuff. And like, it's really sad to watch her do that because you know it's not true.
Yeah.
And then they have some weird kinky sex. And then she starts like throwing up blood or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think she has a breakdown. She starts crying and sobbing. Yeah. Yeah, but you're right. It makes it the first time I watched this movie, when she turns on a dime like that, I was taken aback. Mm. Like I was kind of caught off guard, and I don't think I fully realized in the moment what she was doing. I realized it as it went on, but it is so jarring to see her go like do that 180 and just start saying the nastiest shit she can think of to him. And yeah, it's an act of desperation of if I make him not love me anymore, it'll be easier for him when I'm gone.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
Yeah. This one also has big plague underpinnings.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think differently than the first two, I feel like in the first one, the plague is sort of there, but it's not really focused on that much. It's got some, it's got the great shot of them carrying the caskets and stuff, but you don't really see it really touching the people.
Yeah.
The Herzog one has this, goes into it more and has this, again, like this really dreamlike sort of sequence where the town is just falling to pieces in a really interesting kind of way because they know that the end is nigh and all this kind of stuff. This is the first one where the plague is actually affecting the main characters of the movie.
Yes.
In a pretty real way that is blurring the line between plague and vampire.
Yes.
Because in the previous two, it's like, oh, yes, the vampire is metaphor for plague. This one, it's like, eh, he's kind of both. Like, it's
right.
He kind of literally is the plague and right. literally is a vampire.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think that Eggers was smart to not try to out Herzog, the Herzog version,
mm-hmm.
and not focus too much on those sort of surrealist, dreamlike visuals of the yeah. town eating itself during the plague.
Just to quick aside there, I was thinking about that a lot during the scene with the Romani,
because
I hadn't watched the Herzog one in a while when yeah. we had seen this one the first time.
Yeah.
But we have just watched it relatively recently. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I was like, man, I really like this scene in this one.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, the amount of authenticity Herzog can get from a bunch of people who are probably from down the street
yeah.
just standing there
yeah.
is so much more effective mm-hmm. than all of the backflipping, literal and figurative, they're doing in this one.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me that there's a certain, I don't know. It's like, it goes into my thoughts on the three of these as a whole that yeah. we can get into later. But anyway, sure. Plague.
Plague. I think it's a smart choice to make the plague a more direct influence on the characters you've met in this movie, rather than do the Herzog thing of like, we're going to watch, you know, the parades of caskets and the people getting drunk and eating their last supper and, you know, trying to rope Ellen into a dance on the street. Like, I think it was smart not to try and do that again. Mm. I think tonally it wouldn't have worked with this movie really. And it keeps that knife's edge of, like you were saying, I don't want to call it realism, but it is closer to, you know, you could kind of say, of course, there's no vampire. People are actually getting sick. And having that scene with Anna where she's on the floor and the rats are like biting her through the torn nightgown. That's one of the images in this movie that I was like, oh, this is the part that's a horror movie.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So much of the rest of this is sort of a weird psychosexual gothic movie. And that was one of the ones where it's like, yeah, I also would be. That one freaks me out. The idea of like you're asleep and rats start chewing on you.
Not ideal.
Yeah, not great.
But that does bring me to something else I want to talk about, which is, so when we watched the Herzog one, there are a number of kind of classic bits of imagery or classic set pieces from the original that he more or less does a riff on.
Yeah.
To I think great effect. And in this one, I was a little surprised that they didn't really do that. Like you said, like they've got the casket march, but it's like in the background through like an alleyway,
yeah.
so you don't really get any of it.
Yeah.
You don't get the standing straight up. Well, I guess you do, but he's naked, but he doesn't do the classic like standing straight up thing.
Right.
At least from the waist up anyway.
Yeah, the vampire
yeah.
arms crossed and they come up stiff as a board.
The boat stuff. And the boat stuff in both versions, there's this great moment where Orlok very slowly walks across the with the sail behind him and everything.
Yes.
And it's like, yes.
Orlok on the stairs with the hands.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which they kind of do a little bit. In this one, it was like, I found myself thinking, oh, this is like in Casino Royale, where they just didn't want to use the James Bond theme. Where it's like, we're making a James Bond movie, but, you know, we're only going to use that at the very end of the movie. It's like that sort of modern take on reboots, where it's like, we're not going to emulate the famous thing from the movie because we're trying to do our own thing. But then in my head, I'm like, well, what's the point of doing this then? But I'm also like, well, I appreciate that they're doing something different. But I'm split on how I feel about it.
I can tell.
Because like on the one hand, I was thinking, oh man, I can't wait to see how he handles X. And then when it gets to X and he's kind of like, yeah, hand on the stairs, whatever. I'm like, okay. I mean, there's so much other stuff in this movie
right.
that stands on its own.
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
It didn't bother me the way it bothered you.
Yeah.
I think that they do some other pretty indelible images in mm-hmm. this movie that work really well and are maybe not direct. Maybe some of them are. I mean, pretty close. Like, I think the moment with Hutter on the road and he kind of is walking and he hits the crossroads mm. and the carriage kind of comes almost flying right up to him and he freaks out and sort of closes his eyes like he's going to get hit. And then mm-hmm. when he turns, it's just like sitting there in the middle of the crossroads waiting for him mm-hmm. empty. And I think that works really well. And that's a very striking image, you know, of this misty, snowy forest in the middle of nowhere and a man alone on the road in this ghostly carriage appearing.
Yeah.
And then the scenes where you sort of get Orlok's hand, like his shadow of his hand coming across the entire city of yeah. Visborg. Like mm-hmm. this movie has so many of those big images, you know, von Franz in front of the fire and all of that. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of like how many of those sort of striking images can you pack into this one movie and until it lessens the impact right. of each one?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get it. And I think he was shooting it in a very different style.
Oh, definitely.
Than
yeah.
the other movies where yeah. it sort of made sense that he was going for this very different focus.
Yeah. I, you know, when I saw the first trailer and I was a little worried because it looked more, what's the word I'm looking for? Movie-ish than I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Lighthouse and The Witch mm-hmm. and even Northman are pretty grounded feeling.
Sure.
And doesn't do a ton of like CGI backgrounds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw some of the first shots of this movie, like going up to the castle and stuff, I was like, oh, I don't know. This kind of feels like any other Dracula movie, you know? And watching the full thing, I think it's like 75-25 for me, good stuff to stuff where I'm like, like, I think it, I don't know if it's a negative or if it's just not what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Like the worst shots in the movie, I think, are when they are gondolaing down the canal.
Cause yeah.
that's like the one real shot where it's like, this looks like they're on a green screen.
Yeah.
And it took me right out of it. Cause like the rest of it is so like the way all these costumes and look and sets and stuff and mm-hmm. the way you're lighting, it feels so, natural and grounded.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got this shot and it's like, this looks like Van Helsing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I won't argue with you about that shot. I didn't love that either.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of got what they were trying to do, but it was just didn't hit the way the other things hit.
Yeah.
But the thing I really like about this version is the focus on faces and reactions.
Yeah.
I feel like you get more of that in this where you get to watch the characters go through it on a closer level, especially with Thomas and Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much more of a focus on Ellen, not just her like creepy sleepwalking out on the balcony. Like, you get a lot of close-ups of her when she's talking about things that she's going through, about her experiences and how this is all feeling for her. And I think Lily Rose Depp did an amazing job.
Yeah, she is. We should talk about her specifically because she's the biggest surprise, I think, coming out of this movie. Because, like, I don't even know if I'd seen her in anything. I mean, I knew she was Johnny Depp's daughter.
Yeah.
I knew she had done like one of Kevin Smith's shittier movies.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I wasn't expecting much. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I wasn't excited when I heard her casting.
Yeah, and boy,
like, oh, okay.
Boy, if ever there was someone worthy of the heir to Isabella Johnny.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Seriously. It's a difficult shoes to fill. And she did a really great job. Like the convulsing and the like all the scenes where she's kind of having her fits
mm-hmm.
are crazy. But even the more subtle ones where she's like when at the very beginning when Thomas tries to give her the flowers and mm-hmm. she's so angry and she's trying so hard to hold it together because he's leaving. Mm-hmm. So she's trying to be a pleasant wife because that's what she's supposed to do. But you can tell she's so pissed and she finally tells him just throw the flowers away.
Yes.
Like she's so angry, but like vibrating with it almost.
Yeah. Her physical acting in this is like, I think it is on the level of something like Possession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not just that one scene in Possession. Like it's, she does that like three or four times across this.
Yeah. Exhausting.
Yeah. And that there's the scene when she's arguing with Hutter towards the end where she starts mm-hmm. insulting him and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's one shot of them getting into the argument and then her starting to convulse and then her eyes roll back into her head and she like starts, her mouth gets really wide to the point where you can't really tell if it's real or if they tweaked it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's a really astonishing performance.
Yeah. Yeah. She was fantastic. I pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. On the other end of things,
mm.
this might be controversial.
Okay.
I feel like the weak spot in this movie, surprisingly enough, is Willem Dafoe.
Interesting.
He is the one who feels like he's in a movie to me.
Hmm.
Normally I would think, oh yeah, slam dunk. But there's something about, I don't know, I just don't find him as convincing as everybody else.
Do you think some of that's the nature of the character? You know what I mean? When you're the Paracelsian who's mm-hmm. been cast out of polite society, who, you know, is trying to turn your cauldron into gold or whatever because of the stars. How do you play that character as grounded as the other human characters in this movie?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know if maybe it has something to do with just the fact that it's him and he's kind of the, it's not a particularly chameleon-like role for him. Like, say, The Lighthouse or... did you see Poor Things?
No, not yet.
So good. He's fucking awesome in it. Everybody's awesome in it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it would be a pretty good back-to-back with this one because Poor Things is basically like a psychosexual Frankenstein movie. So
sounds great.
But yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just the Dafoe of it all stands out too much to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, every time I'm like, okay, I'm in on all these guys.
Yeah.
Except him when he shows up, I'm like, something about it just isn't clicking for me.
Yeah. It is interesting because he is tonally such a different character than all the others. Like everyone else is kind of arguing about is this disease? Is this something else? How do we stop it? What's going on? And he's, you know, making grand proclamations about, you know, demons and like chanting, you know, by the power of Elagor, blah, blah, blah. Tell me, give me your speech. And you know, he's just such a, he's having a very different time than everyone else.
Did you watch the extended version?
No, I didn't.
So I watched the extended version. And
I want to.
Only thing, honestly, it's not any different. The only thing that I think is different is there is a, I'm pretty sure this is not in the normal version.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scene where Willem Dafoe is looking at a leech. And basically, it's another exposition scene where he kind of explains what vampires are.
Okay.
And so I was like, okay, I can see why they cut this. At this point in the movie, we don't really need to know this.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, well,
we're all on board.
Ancient monsters that suck the blood. Yeah, we get it.
Yeah.
We've seen it happen already. Because it's only 4 minutes longer. And I think that is probably about how long that scene is.
That's really interesting that it's a whole extended cut for like one additional scene.
Anything back in the good old DVD days, they would do that shit all the time.
That's true.
To get a couple extra bucks out of you.
Yeah.
I fell for that a lot. Because I kept hoping that it was like, oh shit, okay, so we're going to get the real cut here.
Yeah.
Because you hear so much about movies that are censored and
Right, and oh, well, the director really wanted it to be more like this, but they had to cut a bunch out, and then you find out it's like, I don't know, 6 minutes of...
Yeah, it's like, it's... Yeah. And it's like, I don't know what's going on in people's heads where it's like, oh man, the unrated version of American Pie, I bet this one has like full penetration in
yeah.
it. You know, it's like, no, like it doesn't.
It's just going to become a porno.
No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just, it has like a different dick joke.
Right, right. Two additional dick jokes.
Two additional dick yeah. jokes, yeah. What are we talking about? Vampires.
Dick jokes.
But yeah, going into the, I love the final sequence when they go out to, when she tricks, well, when she, what's the word I'm looking for? Deceives her husband.
The fancier word for tricks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Into leaving the house. And I think it's so funny where it's like Willem Dafoe's on board. And then once Hutter figures it out, he's like, yeah. Yeah, she fucking got you.
Yeah. How do you feel about the Harding family subplot?
It is definitely the most screen time the Harding family gets in the three of these versions of the story.
Which is part of why I wanted to ask about it, because one of my complaints, I forget about which version now, was that, you know, Hutter just drops Ellen off with these people and then pieces out. And it's kind of like,
second
wait,
one,
what?
They're just like, hi, guys.
Yeah, hello, goodbye. And it's like, wait, what? But who are they? Why is she? What is? And then what happens to them? We never find out. They're just gone. They're there to like babysit her. And then they're gone.
I think does the wife die in the?
I don't remember.
I don't even remember.
I don't remember.
Doesn't matter.
But I was just curious how do you feel about the expanded Harding family?
I like it as a counterpoint to Hutter and Ellen.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I can't tell you the last time I saw two children get murdered by a vampire on screen.
There you go.
So that's always a plus.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's... I like them as a counterpoint. I like them. I think they flesh out Hutter and Ellen a bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, you got to have the one guy who's like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
What are you, monsters?
You're all insane.
I'm the harbor master. I don't believe this or whatever he is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This foolishness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it for those reasons as well. And I liked that it gave, making them more characters gave Ellen more to do.
Yeah.
Like it gives her more to play off of and like, oh, okay. Like this is her best friend. And then her husband, their husbands are friends. And then she's got tension with Friedrich. So that's interesting. It adds a new level of, you know, him kicking them out of the house, because especially during a plague, like you're much safer staying with the rich people.
Yeah.
You know, who can afford like,
well,
the doctor.
You'd think so.
Well,
that, but excuse me, Edgar Allan Poe has entered the chat.
That's true. But back then that was kind of the thought, you know, is like, well, we'll stay in his nice, big fancy house and we'll be safer here. And then it's like, no, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And him kicking them out at the height of the plague is like, that's fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, that's, he's putting them in real danger by sending them out where they're not going to have servants to go run errands and clean things for them. They're going to have to do it themselves.
God forbid.
Yeah. But during the plague, you know,
yeah.
Layer of protection.
And I think that Ellen, Anna, in the minimal amount of stuff that she has to do, I think they get across her and Ellen's friendship enough that when she and her kids are put in danger, it's a legitimate, because I mean this is kind of the first time that the Dracula character has used her friends as blackmail material, basically, or what's the word I'm looking for, not blackmail, extortion.
The threat is real. Because like the people, she actually has stuff to lose beyond just Thomas. She has friends and people she cares about who he can prey upon.
And I'm surprised Ellen didn't pick it up a little bit after her friend with the unborn child was killed.
They'd
be like, okay, we don't need to do this again. Day two, I understand. Don't kill the kids.
Yeah.
Bite me as much as you want.
I also think that having that final image of Friedrich, who's gone mad with grief and plague and gone back to the mausoleum where his family has been laid to rest, and he has gone in and opened his dead wife's casket to embrace her one last time as he dies, and then Von Franz and Hutter go and find him, they're in a very sexual position, mm-hmm. kind of in the background there with him on top. And he's like pulled her leg out of the casket.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's very, it's tough to get in there.
But it's really intense. Yeah. Like, it's a really fucked up image that he's kind of in this like passionate embrace with his dead wife and then he dies.
Yeah. Also, those caskets, very tall.
Yes.
And
a lot of volume.
Not very securely shut, because he just like gently elbows the top of that thing and it comes off. So I don't know what the plan is there.
But. Look, they didn't have time.
Yeah.
It's plague time. They're burying a lot of people.
Honestly, surprising they even got a burial.
Rich.
That's true.
Rich people.
Yeah. But yeah, the final sequence
where
Orlok goes to Ellen and they suck face or other parts.
Chest.
Very good. I don't think it is as... It's tough because I think this Orlok is more monstrous than the other versions.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally don't think that he's more creepy than the other versions. Because I think... When I think about that scene... The first thing I think of is that more dark and shadowy Kinski just kind of like on top of her in the darkness where all you can see is like her face with her eyes open.
Yeah.
And this is like the...
You wanted him to hike up her dress a little more. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, you know, he pulled her shirt down. That was fine. But like it's... I think... That sort of thing doesn't fit this version of Orlok because he is more monstrous than he is kind of like secretive and, you know, I think the thing that's interesting is the way that he sucks blood is very sexual.
Mm-hmm.
It's not erotic.
Yeah.
But it's very sexual.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. I was trying to figure out a way to say that as well. And I think you came up with a better version than me because I couldn't figure out how to say that.
You're just like, gonna say hot?
No, because it's not hot.
It's not.
And that's,
no, it's really not.
That's the point. Is like it's like all of the overtly sexual stuff minus any of the eroticism.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a fascinating line to toe of like it becomes, it kind of turns it all into like a biological urge or process
Very
rather
carnal.
Than, yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 I do like that final. Image though of like Orlok and Ellen locked together and he lifts his head up and he like kind of screams and the blood. I was like fuck yeah
again guitar solo
so good
that's like oh Finnegan. Oh no it's wet outside. Finnegan has thoughts on
he's very excited about the guitar solo.
Yeah, it's I would say it is a definite appropriate upgrade visually to what has happened in the other two.
Yep.
One of which was very rudimentary dissolve. The other of which was dying like a spider or something.
Like a cockroach. Yeah.
And this one is just, you know.
Melting into a bunch of blood.
Death clock.
Yeah.
Metalocalypse.
Yeah.
Nosferatu.
It looked like the cover of a Chelsea Wolfe album.
Yeah.
Which was awesome.
But I think the final shot of the movie of her on of him on top of her and he's just like the it's the first time you get a good look at all of him and he's just literally a bag of bones and he's not impressive and he's just
he's a desiccated corpse.
Really, and the way I remember the first time that I saw it I was a little confused at what I was seeing because I didn't realize that they had put flowers all around them. I thought it looked like mold. Like my first thought was, oh, that's it looks like two bodies that are rotting in like the grass or something.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very arresting image.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there we go. Nosferatu.
Final Feratu.
How would you rank them personally? Which one is your favorite?
I'm going to get yelled at for this. I think this one's my favorite.
I don't think you're going to get yelled at.
I might get yelled at.
Maybe by my dog.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it, and like, as I've said, this is, I think this movie feels like a 2-hour guitar solo.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think my favorite is the Herzog one.
Really?
Because there is, where this is a guitar solo,
mm-hmm.
the Herzog one is more of like a symphony.
Mm.
And I think the Herzog one evokes more of a dreaminess to me.
Oh, yeah.
And more of a creepiness factor. I wish they didn't do the thing at the end where Harker turns into a vampire. That's pretty stupid.
I think it's pretty silly.
Yeah. But everything else, there's just something about it that every time I think about Nosferatu, I find myself skewing back to that one.
Mm.
And I don't want to say, I think maybe my problem, like I was saying with the CGI stuff, is that it's the parts of this movie that feel too modern.
Sure.
And as much as I like what they did with Orlok, I think his full body prosthesis, like makeup job, feels a little too modern.
Mm.
Where like Kinski is got like a light dusting of white paint,
yeah,
a bald cap, and some weird teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like there's just something more tangible to me about that than, you know, being covered in a rubber suit. Now, as much as I do like that.
Yeah, I think for me it still works because his sort of, to borrow your word, used tangible.
Mm-hmm.
I think the intangibility and the divorced from human version of Orlok in this is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think if they had tried to hew too closely to the Max Schreck Kinski look, it would have felt maybe even more out of place.
Yeah, it's possible. You know,
in this version of this world where it definitely has its nightmare and dreamlike elements, but there's also, you know, scenes where it's just like people walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you then have that version of Orlok show up with the, like, super smooth white head and the big pointy ears and, like, you know, the whole thing. Everybody would be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, what is this?
Yeah.
Whereas having, you know, this version of Orlok where he... It's kind of a question if people are even seeing him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is this just symbol of disease and decay.
Yeah, I think the where my sensibility skews is that, what am I trying to say? Where my sensibility skews is that Robert Eggers is someone who is like obsessed with detail,
mm-hmm.
and like. I can see, or I can imagine the amount of detail that went into designing Orlok.
Yeah.
And like the fact that he's this full body thing just screams detail to me where it's like, okay, but his shoulders got to be fucking weird too. Mm. You know, like there's every line in his face has to be.
You think it's like overthought?
I don't want to say it's overthought, but it's like my sensibility skews more towards the Herzog one because the Herzog one feels a little bit more impressionist to me.
Okay, yeah.
As much as the original is expressionist. the Herzog one feels like more of like a watercolor painting instead of like a photorealistic rendering.
I see what you're saying.
And I think that's...
You what? Like having that sort of space for interpretation.
Yeah, like I said, the scene with the Romani, as much as I love what they do in this one and how intense it is, and I mean, listen, as much as I love Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the worst thing that did for vampire fiction is made it incredibly easy to kill vampires.
Uh-huh.
I love a vampire staking that it has rules and ceremony.
Yeah, where you need a beautiful naked young lady on a white horse to be led to the grave of the vampire.
A very specifically 3-foot-long spike that needs to grow through into the, you know, all this kind of, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
But like, I find there to be something more authentic about Herzog just being like, yeah, here's a bunch of Romani people I found next door. They're not even doing it. They're just sitting there. And it just putting a camera on these people's faces is like more production value than you could get from $1 million of set design, you know?
That's fair.
So it's I do really, really like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I will watch it multiple times after this, probably. Yep. But yeah, I think my favorite is the Herzog one.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to cover? I think that was pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
We are more or less back to normal as far as what we're doing on on our list here.
Yes.
So I've hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 beep, boop. And up next is number 154, Tremors.
Oh, yay.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Perfect early, late spring, early summer movie.
Yes.
Love Tremors.
Big fan.
Yes.
Of Tremors.
Nice.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
On Patreon, mm-hmm. where if you would like to follow along on our remakes and reboots series we're doing on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. Our May movie is, I believe, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to stick with that, or do we want to save that till later in the summer and do The Wicker Man now?
Ooh.
Because we are in Wicker Man time here at the beginning of May.
I like it. Let's do it.
Okay. Okay, so we are officially changing. May's Patreon movie will be The Wicker Man. So that means at some point, I got to check the calendar, make sure we have enough weeks to do this because we have to. Let's see. What's today? Today is the 9th?
Yes.
Or the 8th?
Today is the 8th.
So we might not actually have time to do that. Okay, well, if we're going to do that, then instead of Tremors, we have to do The Wicker Man next. The original Wicker
Man. I will never object.
Okay.
To rewatching The Wicker Man.
We will be covering The Wicker Man.
Sorry for screwing everybody up if you were excited about Tremors.
Sorry, Tremheads.
Tremors is more of like a summer movie to me anyway.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
So next time we will be doing number 81.
Yay.
Which is The Wicker Man.
Yes.
Which I'm surprised. I'm expecting another big shakeup on this list because I will be shocked if Sinners isn't on this list at some point in the near future. And I feel like The Wicker Man is the only movie I can think of that you can talk about in tandem with Sinners. Maybe From Dusk Till Dawn, like the two of those put together gets you Sinners.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a different conversation.
You can come to my house to watch The Wicker Man. I'll light my hand of glory.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Where do you put that?
Where do I put it?
Yeah, it's like you put it in the bathroom?
Wherever I want to put it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does it do?
I'll tell you later.
Cool. Well, thank you guys for listening. And again, if you want to help support the show, follow us in our remake. And oh god, I just realized that means we have to watch the Wicker Man remake this month.
I was waiting for it to sink into you that it wasn't too. We weren't watching the original Wicker Man twice.
Highs and lows, stream highs and
not the bees.
Not the bees. Anyway, patreon.com/thepenskyfile if you want to follow along with that. Thank you guys for your support. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay. Thanks, everyone.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye.